We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program. This is Focus on WILL. I'm Jay Pierce, sitting in for this hour of the program. And joining us for a regular visit, Dr. Suzanne Troopen, obstetrician and gynecologist with Women's Health Practice in Champaign and clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois. And we are here in this hour. It's one of our service programs on a regular basis to take your questions about women's health, reproductive health, children's reproductive potential. New birth control options will be one of the topics we'll be talking about today. And hopefully you'll join in the conversation with your questions and comments. 217-333-9455 is our local number, 333-9455. Or if it's long distance, you can use our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. And feel free to jump on the line anytime, and we'll get to your questions as the program goes along. As usual, it's one of those situations when we have medical advice on the air that we can't probably diagnose a specific situation for which you should see your own doctor or seek medical attention. But in general, we can talk about various topics. Maybe in particular in today's program, Suzanne has said new birth control options will be something we'd like to discuss in this hour. And welcome, first of all.
Thank you. And good morning.
This is the first time we've gotten to do the program together, which is great. I've certainly have listened to you over the years when you've been on with David and or Celeste and Rita Schulte, who actually I'm sitting in for today. Rita had to be out. So
we had a little bit of a pass the ball this morning.
I'm filling in for the fill-in.
Exactly.
And glad to do it. Well, you had come in and said this morning that new birth control options would be a good topic. And so what direction do you want to take that in?
There are 80 different birth control pills out there. Actually, there are more now. And so you would think that that's enough. But actually, side effects and issues with compliance have plagued contraceptive use for many years. And in the United States, we still have about half of all pregnancies conceived each year, even today in 2010, are listed by the woman as quote-unquote unplanned. Now, not every unplanned pregnancy is an unwanted pregnancy, but statistically it tells us that approximately half the unplanned pregnancies are also not, the patient was not desirous of becoming pregnant. So more effective contraception is a goal for both patients and their healthcare providers. And to that end, they have still been working in the pharmaceutical research divisions on making a better birth control pill.
Mm-hmm.
So the birth control pill celebrated its 50th birthday, but it's undergone probably more than 50 tweaks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that would put it about in 1959, 60?
Yes.
60 or so when it began. And now you say there are more than 80 different options.
Yes, there are.
Pill,
right,
et cetera, et cetera.
So the first generation pills were what we called monophasic, mm-hmm. and they were what we also call cyclic. So a monophasic pill has the same hormone in each pill that you swallow, and it is also phasic in that it is designed to have a menstrual period each month. So we've changed that up a little bit, and we've come up with pills that are designed such that some have different doses of the type of hormone that you take each day, and it is true that women don't necessarily, quote-unquote, have to have a menstrual period every month. And because some women have better bleeding patterns, actually having that, what is technically medically a withdrawal bleed, not truly a menstrual period, but for women that do bleed at least every 28 days, they're a little less likely to have that spot bleeding, that annoying breakthrough bleeding that leads to many women discontinuing their pills. So we've retooled the birth control pill into something that gives you an extraordinarily light period. And that works for people who have normal menstrual periods, but it even better, it works for women who have very heavy menstrual periods. Mm-hmm. So the currently number one selling pill in Europe, a pill with the name of Qlara, it's Q-L-I-A-R-A, I think. Mm-hmm. We don't call it that here, so I think it's called that. But Bayer Healthcare has now released the first what we call quadriphasic pill. And the other thing that is very fascinating about this pill, it is the first where the estrogen becomes a bioidentical type of estrogen in our system. So for many women, it's a very well-tolerated pill. And the bleeding profile is such that when you have your once-a-month period, the period is extremely light. So it's a new type of estrogen progesterone presented, and it is quadriphasic, which is also new. And actually, in Europe, it is actually approved for the treatment of heavy menstrual bleeding, which the FDA did not actually give it that indication in the U.S., which is a reason they came up with a new name. And in the United States, we call it Nastazia. And it's, I think, N-A-T-A-Z-I-A. And one of the reasons was it is has different approvals than what they have in Europe. But that is one of the newer breakthroughs.
Mm-hmm. Well, excuse me. One of the things, because you brought that up, the volume of bleeding, acne has been another thing that birth control pills has had an impact on, and so sometimes a birth control pill may be desired not because you're really
not because
aiming
of
for birth control.
Exactly. So we've called it the pill. We've called it birth control for a long time, but it's much broader use than that.
Yeah.
And what you're talking about is what physicians call the non-contraceptive benefits. And there are so many. Actually, it can help prevent ovarian cancer. Birth control pill use can help prevent endometrial cancer, which is lining cancer of the uterus. We actually estimate that if all women, and not all women can safely take the pill, but if all women in the U.S. were to be able to take birth control pills for at least 10 years, we would probably prevent 80% of all ovarian cancer.
Seriously.
That's kind of an estimate, but which is fascinating. So, yes, many pills, several pills, are actually approved for the indication of acne. Mm-hmm. That is in women also seeking contraception. The approval by the FDA has that caveat to it, but yes, absolutely, even teens that are not sexually active can benefit by going on a hormonal contraception.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The reason it works is two reasons, again. One is it decreases the amount of male hormone produced by the ovary, and two, it increases the SHBG, which is sex hormone binding globulin from the liver, which binds up that male hormone and prevents it from being active in the skin and causing pimples. Simple.
So you're blaming the male hormone for zits. All right, we'll take that. 333-9455 if you'd like to join the conversation. 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Join us at any point. Talking primarily about new birth control options today with Dr. Suzanne Troopin, who's making her regular visit to the program. I'm Jay Pierce, filling in for Rita Schulte, who would have been filling in for David Inch in this hour. Focus.
There's a new alternative, too, that also by Bayer Healthcare,
mm-hmm.
and they seem to rapidly becoming the leader in innovations in contraception. They brought us Yaz, which helps for PMDD, or the most severe form of PMS, and now they've modified that same formulation that is in Yaz, and they've added a type of B vitamin, a derivative of folic acid, and it becomes folic acid in your system. So for young women who might be planning a pregnancy relatively soon or might conceive, even as I said at the beginning of the show, unplanned, they can through the birth control pill use, get an adequate amount of folic acid daily. And that is critically important because we know that folic acid is tied with what is called neural tube defects, so various spinal defects, and some brain defects as well, but most of us know about spina bifida and some of the spinal cord defects. And by taking an adequate amount of folic acid per day, we can almost virtually eliminate many of these open neural tube defects.
Seriously? Wow. So when you talk about, you know, for instance, we're looking at the benefits of, the acne, let's say, stifling the male growth hormone or blocking it. So are there other things that are not birth control pills that can do the same thing?
In terms of acne, yes. Of course, good skincare is critically important.
But a pill that does the same thing the birth control pill does, but it's not a birth control device.
So, there are antibiotics that people use to control acne. And, of course, people do use Accutane, which is a derivative of vitamin A, but that has a direct skin effect. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the actual hormonal manipulation in order to control acne, no. But acne is one of those conditions that is what we call, it has many different etiologies, so it has many causes that actually contribute, and not all causes contribute equally in each person. So some people can never wash their face hardly at all and seem to never have any skin issues, and others wash their skin all the time. Of course, harsh soaps and inappropriate washing. They even talk about how tap water is bad for your skin. That was
really?
A news alert on one of the health news channels that I surf on the internet regularly.
Okay. But, a study funded by Evian or something?
Probably.
Buy bottled water to wash your face with.
Probably water is not necessarily always the best thing to wash your face with. Probably actually soaps that clean your face and debris it.
Yeah.
Things that actually get in there and physically clean your face. But nothing that works quite like a birth control pill. So those non-contraceptive benefits help quite a bit. Hmm. And actually, the same physiologic way that oral contraceptives work to control acne by controlling male hormone production from the ovary actually is one of the ways that birth control pills help control what's called polycystic ovarian condition, or condition where a woman may have cystic ovaries as well as elevated levels of male hormone as well as unwanted hair growth. And unless you control the origins of that hair growth, it's tough to get rid of the hair. So patients may be coming in for laser treatment of that hair or even simple waxings of that hair. And unless we really get to the bottom of what their hormones are doing and what other things we can do to keep those male hormones down, it's somewhat tough sometimes to get those skin treatments to be as effective.
Yeah. Fascinating. All right. Our numbers are 217-333-9455 or 800-222-9455 if you want to join the conversation with Dr. Troopin today here on Focus. What else is on your agenda here that you brought?
Well, there was a very interesting story that I wondered how many people saw. Originated out of Sweden, and it talked about ultrasound pregnancy dating of girl babies. And one thing we know of when we look at, say, a full-grown adult female versus a full-grown adult male is adult females are smaller frame, shorter than average adult male. So no mystery there. We even see those physiologic differences in heights and weights appear quite early in childhood and, of course, in puberty. But we've not really taken that into consideration in terms of ultrasonic measurements. Mm-hmm. So that when you go in for your pregnancy ultrasound, your physician is dating your pregnancy based on your ethnicity. So we have normalized because some populations, they do grow at slightly different rates. So usually there are several tables built into our machine. So unbeknownst to the patient, we're probably picking a table that is appropriate to our population. But what they're finding is that, in fact, even in the early second trimester of pregnancy, the time when we usually use the measurements to determine a due date, if we don't have a last menstrual period, even at that point in time, girl fetuses are smaller than boy fetuses. And they've just done this massive study in Sweden where they had done one of these studies before, but they now have looked at 770,000 births.
Wow.
And compiled their ultrasound dating. So a fascinating study. And they are now saying that there has been, quote unquote, systematic misclassification of babies. And their point was that by the time the girl babies are getting to full term, sometimes their doctors think they're not quite due, but in fact they may be actually now overdue, and the consequences of being overdue may be kicking in unbeknownst to the patient and her doctor because she's been slightly misclassified by these differences.
Mm-hmm. By the profiles, yeah.
So this is literally hot off the international press, so it's going to be very interesting to see how physicians in the United States incorporate this new information into taking care of their pregnant moms.
Yeah. Okay. Well, perhaps we'll count on you to follow that and report back to us, you know, in the months that you come. All right. We have a call on line one from St. Joe, first up, and you're on the air with Dr. Troopman. Good morning.
I was wondering if you could talk about women being on the pill when they have a history of migraines, if that is a problem.
So back in the 70s, studies were done showing that women who took birth control pills and had migraines were at increased risk of stroke. And for many years, we did not give women with migraines birth control pills whatsoever. But if we flip over and look at women who have migraines who are pregnant, we realize that actually about a third get better during their pregnancy, about a third get worse, and the other third actually stay the same. So using that same rationale and the rationale that being pregnant has massively high estrogen levels compared to, say, being on a birth control pill, we started to relook at the safe use of oral contraception in women who have migraines. And when we look at that, there are a couple of important issues. One is to get the right diagnosis, and some people really just have exaggerated tension headaches and not truly migraines. So you got to get the right diagnosis. The other is if you have migraines with what is called aura or other neurologic symptoms. And this group that has migraines with aura probably is in a higher risk group. And they are classified as being discouraged from birth control pill use unless there's nothing else for contraception. So when we weigh her risks and benefits, if we can't come up with a more successful method of contraception, she might be a candidate to be followed on a trial of a very low dose of birth control pills. But there are so many other good alternatives. Of course, condoms would be very safe. Non-medicated IUDs, even the medicated IUD has such a low dose of medication, it shouldn't affect the migraines. And also, we do not think that POPs or progesterone only birth control pills or the progesterone based contraceptives, Depo-Provera, the Implanon rods, that those in fact would probably increase the risk of stroke either. So when you have migraines, it is something that you have to work with your individual provider on. But
okay,
that's
well,
the
thank
story.
You for the information.
Okay, thank you very much for the call. And we go to line two. We have a caller on the line from Urbana this morning. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I have a question. I guess my question is about the pills in general and use of hormones in the woman's body. I know a lot of naturopathic doctors and so forth discourage the heavy use of hormones. It sounds like your guest seems to think that there are only positive benefits to using the contraceptive pills, but I had wanted to hear more about some of the reasons why people might choose not to, and why there is some skepticism about those pills if they're not tested very thoroughly. I know there's a lot of changes that happen to them with the drug companies that don't always get thoroughly tested before re-release, et cetera. And I just wanted to hear some of her thoughts on that issue.
Okay, we can ask.
Yeah, I'm listening. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there are definitely known side effects to the birth control pill, particularly if we look at women over the age of 35 who smoke. They're generally not candidates for the use of birth control pills, and there are probably some increased risk as well for individuals with that do smoke who are under the age of 35. So we get rid of smoking, that's definitely doesn't mix well with birth control pills. That's number one. We have to look at groups of 10,000 women in order to show increased risks of blood clots so that we know that our natural rate of having a blood clot in our population is about 1 in 10,000. And when we're pregnant, the average, if you have no inherited risk factors, and you're not older and you don't smoke and so forth, your risk would go up when you're pregnant in that range of probably 10 in 10,000, could be as low in some studies as 7 in 10,000. On the older generation birth control pills, we had rates increase that were double or triple the rate of natural risk of blood clots. So we increase our risk from 1 in 10,000 to 2 or 3, but not as high as from pregnancy. And on some of the newer generation pills, the risk, depending on the studies, were in that 3 to 7 range. So again, much higher than your natural risk, but not as high as in pregnancy. So there are definite known risks. Some women will have a creep up in their blood pressure. Some women will have other minor side effects, minor headache increase. Other women will have other kinds of side effects. So there's no doubt about it that there are a significant number of women who have used the birth control pill in the range of millions around the world each day. And so the list of potential side effects is impressive, and you have to go over these with your own physician. And then we have to take the context of hormones. It is a big topic. We have hormones circulating in our body. So when you are taking a hormone medication, you're introducing other hormones, but you're suppressing some of your own hormones. So it potentially for some people is balancing. And yet for other women, it's not balancing. And in those early months, your own ovary production of hormones may not be completely suppressed. So in the early months, the transition months, your own hormone production is high enough in combination with the birth control pill that we see some of the side effects early in the use that don't necessarily persist. In terms of testing of contraception, actually the testing of contraceptives is probably much more rigorous and intense than many of the medications that we do test. Many medications that are tested for, say, a particular entity, say, a particular disease, well, we have to find those individuals that not only have that disease, but qualify for the study and are willing to do the study. For contraceptive studies, very often it's the general healthy population that is being studied, and therefore many, many studies have enrolled thousands of women and have thousands of pregnancy cycles. And actually, many of these trials are conducted in many countries worldwide to give us additional information on different ethnicities and different diets and different lifestyles, as well as the birth control itself. So actually, it's a very open book when it comes to testing of the contraceptives. And there's a website, clinicaltrial.org, and you can go on to that. You can get to it from the NIH site if you would like. I think centerwatch.com also can get you to most of those trials as well. And you can find the national registry number for trials that are undergoing. You can look at the type of studies that are being done, the type of studies that have been done. It's a very open book. So in that respect, I think that we have a tremendous amount of safety built into the study of oral contraceptives.
All right. Well, there you go. Pretty complete answer. And I guess clinicaltrial.org, again, is a website you can go for more information. This is Focus on WILL. I'm Jay Pierce, sitting in as the host today. Dr. Suzanne Troopin is making a regular visit. She is an obstetrician, a gynecologist with Women's Health Practice in Champaign, and a clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at University of Illinois. And our phone number is 333-9455. If you have a question or would like to join the conversation, 800-222-9455 if it's long distance, but locally 333-9455. And we're generally talking about new birth control options, but women's health in general is fair game today. And just a question, since we're talking about a lot of the we've talked a lot about birth control pills and the various forms and the various we've gotten into some side effects, and we've talked about some of the benefits in other areas besides birth control. What percentage of birth control use is the pill? Versus condoms versus IUD versus whatever else people are using?
Well, of course, condom use overlaps use of other contraceptive methods. If we look at individuals over the age of 35, and if we look at the U.S. population, because worldwide it's very different. Worldwide, IUD use is massively high percentage-wise. I think there are something like 70 million women in China using IUDs. Impressive number. But over the age of 35, sterilization is the primary method for couples, and it's not necessarily just the female who's sterilized. Of course, vasectomy is part of that, but female bilateral tubal ligation after a birth or at the time of laparoscopy has been our standard, and now we have methods that are somewhat equivalent to performing a vasectomy. We have the Esure coils and the Adiana tubal inserts. They take about 10 to 15 minutes to insert. They can be inserted under local anesthesia or mild sedative. Mm-hmm. In an office type setting, some physicians only have the ability to do those procedures in a ambulatory surgical setting, but it's more equivalent to a vasectomy. And so sterilization in that group is the most popular. And then a longer-term methods like IUDs are starting to become more popular in the over the 35 age group as well. Now, when you take teens and early 20s, birth control pill use is still the number one method in the U.S. And in terms of each age group that's looked at, as we get a little bit older, it becomes a little bit greater percentage of birth control pill use. Teens tend to favor Depo-Provera and things that can be administered with fewer health behaviors, so to speak. Still, lack of consistent contraceptive use is still a a big percentage. And but once we get solidly into the 20s in the United States, birth control pill use, and in some studies, it's as high as 40 to 60% of the contracepting population.
Wow. Now, one of the things that, and I'm not obviously a scholar, I'm a 55-year-old male, so probably in these days not as big of a scholar as I could be, but it seems to me that, you know, birth control pills, which do not, and correct me if I'm wrong, do not stop the transmission of diseases, which seem to be rampant these days and growing, and all kinds that we never knew about 25, 30, 40 years ago. It would seem kind of counterintuitive that the pill would be the chosen method of birth control in a population that seems susceptible to getting these diseases.
Well, you bring out a good point, and in and of themselves, they aren't designed to be protective against sexually transmitted diseases. Now, we do know that because the hormone changes the mucus of the cervix, that in women who acquire chlamydia, for instance, they're less likely to actually get pelvic inflammatory disease if they are on the birth control pill than if they're not on the birth control pill. And so there are ways in which the birth control pill actually factors in to that reduction in the consequences of an STD. So that's extremely important. But you're right that when you have a new partner or someone that you have, neither of you have had STD testing, that it is safest to add in condoms, preferably with spermicide, to help reduce sexually transmitted disease transmission. But the oral contraceptive is going to be a lot more effective. Mm-hmm. We would expect that of oral contraceptive users, if 100 women are using the oral contraception at the end of 1 year, we would only anticipate that somewhere between 1 in 3 of those individuals would be pregnant. Some studies, depending on the population, you could say as high as 6 to 8 of those individuals would be pregnant if they're really not very consistent. But with condom use, the studies show that out of 100 women, that it is much more likely that somewhere in the 15 to 20% will be pregnant at the end of that 1 year. If you consistently use the new emergency contraceptive methods, you know, we nickname them the morning after
morning
pill,
after,
that would,
yeah,
when you get a condom breakage, then that's going to reduce that statistic.
All right. Nothing is perfect, though. Nothing's 100%.
Well, we think abstinence gets pretty close.
Yeah, probably does hit that. But that is not always at the top of the list when you're considering options for some reason. Let me see. Do we have a caller, Jason, on line one from Champaign? Let's take that right now. Good morning.
Good morning. I heard this summer on two sources, CNN and People's Pharmacy, that there was a report out of the British Medical Journal that was raising concerns about taking calcium, as we all do, suggesting that the calcium can leave deposits in the heart in places we don't want it. Have you heard anything about this?
Well, I saw some of those reports,
okay,
and actually one of my patients asked me about this, and it was on my list to actually read those specific reports. So we do know that it's important not to. Balance is important. So the question is, you need a certain amount of calcium in for your bones, but you definitely do not need to overly calcify your body. And I definitely, when I talk to patients, I talk to them about how much calcium is in their food and weigh that against how much they're going to need in their supplements. For instance, even a potato has 60 milligrams of calcium, and nobody seems to be counting the calcium in their potato. So I usually ask people to, if they can, ideally, write down the food that they take in for about 3 days, see if they can get one of those lists. We have a couple in our office, but they're all over the internet or at the public library, and see if you can't play nutritionist and calculate out approximately how much calcium you're getting in your food each day, and then supplement up from there. And then beyond that, you may be getting too much in. Now, as a rough number, we used to say to women, 4,000 milligrams a day is way too much. And also, we all know that it takes vitamin D to absorb our calcium. Mm-hmm. So vitamin D has now been discovered to be so beneficial for so many things that we're all bumping our vitamin D up. So maybe we do need to back off that calcium a little bit. If we're getting a lot more vitamin D, we're going to absorb the calcium that we have. Let's be sure that you really need those extra supplements, because some people do not. And really be sure that you're getting the recommended calcium for your age group and not some recommended amount for a menopausal lady with osteoporosis that doesn't apply to your individual case, for instance. So I think all of that is hand in hand. We do know that individuals deposit calcium in their heart for other reasons. It's usually actually not necessarily in the muscle. It can be in degenerated muscle. It's usually in the blood vessels, in the plaque. That's what heart scans pick up. And in fact, we think that it's important to monitor your cholesterol intake, the amount of exercise you get. And that's what I don't know from some of those studies, how well controlled the other factors that lead to calcium were in those particular groups. And so there's, again, multifactorial situation going on here. Mm-hmm. And to maximize heart health, a lot goes into it. For instance, a new study just came out, isn't exactly what you're asking, but a new study just came out that showed treating early diabetes doesn't affect heart disease. Well, no, it doesn't, because you can't just pull out your blood sugar, not control your cholesterol, not control your weight, not control your fat intake, not control your salt intake, not control your blood pressure. See where I'm going here? Yeah. And all of those things would factor in to your heart calcium. So I know what they're saying. And again, I think that it is important that we're cautionary, and that when we leap into, it was like when we were all leaping into taking massive amounts of some megavitamins, and a lot of my pregnant ladies cropped up pregnant when they were on megavitamins, and that wasn't good. And the idea is that you don't leap into these things without sitting down with your healthcare provider and trying to make enough time. I know it's always difficult, but trying to make enough time to really go over some of these issues rather than doing it completely out of context.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
That helped. Good. Thank you very much for the call. We can take another at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And that segues nicely into what I was going to ask you.
Good.
When you were talking about, you know, sitting down with a healthcare provider, because it is confusing. There's calcium and orange juice. Everything has calcium added to it now because we're so worried about that. The other thing is we're so marketed to when it comes to birth control, when it comes to the different forms of the pill. And one of the things that always strikes me is I get skeptical when a commercial for something is 15 seconds of the product and 45 seconds of side effects and disclaimers. And that indicates to me I better talk to somebody who knows about this before I get all excited about it. So,
well, those advertisements are very frustrating. I think they're very frustrating on both ends.
I was going to ask how it is for you. Do people come in and actually say, I want this because I saw this ad for it and it does all these wonderful things and this is what I want to have happen?
And how, well, do you, Jay, how do you marketing deal with that? Works. That's
yes.
Why they do it.
Yes, it does.
But in terms of marketing messages, most studies indicate that an ad can only be so long. So mm-hmm. After that, we quit paying attention. So what you're talking about is your basic one-minute ad. And the FDA mandates, if you are going to be a drug that has known side effects, the FDA mandates that you include your side effects. And it winds up with these ads being, hey, here I am. I'm a potentially good drug for you. And boom, here are all these. I think if the car companies need to say, hey, if you sit behind the wheel, listen to these bad things that could happen in your life, that would be scary, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's interesting.
I think that it's good. I appreciate that these companies, they've spent some money on their product. They would like their product to have a good market uptake. In order to do that, they're going to have to do some direct market advertising. Drug companies have limited access to even the physicians, and they do some marketing to us, of course, in the way of journal articles and presentations at medical meetings and so forth and so on. It's all a form of information transmittal, however you want to label it. But in general, if an individual has a topic or a need and something pops on the television and it catches their eye, generally, they're going to read about it. They might even look on the internet. They might even chat with friends and family. And when they come in, they're generally a better educated consumer. Hmm. And I think that's good.
But these are still things that you do need to talk to a doctor.
Absolutely.
About.
Ultimately, ideally, we go hand in hand forward with the decision.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Let's take another call from Urbana on line one. And hi, you're on the air with Dr. Troopin. Go ahead, please.
Thanks. I'll just ask the question. In contradiction to what you said a moment ago, I thought there was a movement to reduce or eliminate the use of spermicides in condoms.
Okay, so I'm not sure I understand the question, but there are two issues. One, do you buy a condom with spermicide impregnated into it, or buy it or use a condom and also use some spermicide at the same time? And the condoms without spermicide impregnated into them last longer and hold up better. And so, yes, we encourage that you buy the condoms without pre-impregnated spermicide into the condom itself, but actually using it in addition with the spermicide is generally recommended as a potential extra reduction of sexually transmitted disease. It's not going to be perfect protection. And we're working, I didn't get a chance to mention this, but since you bring up the topic, we're working on things called microbicides, which spermicides can be microbicides, but generally the word microbicides means something specifically designed to kill microbes. Mm. And there's a new vaginal ring contraceptive that is making its way through trials, and it can be worn for an entire year. And they're also looking at vaginal rings that may also be contraceptives or separately that leak microbicides. So actually help protect against actual infection acquisition. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the recommendations are going to exactly be, but possibly in those situations, then condom, no spermicide, just using the microbicide may, in the future, be the way to go.
Okay.
There you go.
Thank you.
Good, good point.
Yeah, good point. Thank you for bringing it up. And line two in Champaign. Good morning. You're on with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'd like to know, this is not about birth control, I'd like to know the name of a surgery that my daughter-in-law had after she delivered her first baby by cesarean section this spring. It was a surgery to stop bleeding, and the doctor described it as trussing her uterus like a rump roast.
Creative. Well, there are incisions. Okay, so a uterus starts its life at approximately 70 grams of tissue and expands in pregnancy to about 1,000 grams of tissue. And some of that is expansion of muscle, but quite a bit of it is actually blood within the body itself. And in order to supply that big organ and to bring in blood vessels that transmit all the good nutrients across the placenta, women grow very, very large blood vessels into the wall of the uterus. And then once the baby's out, once the placenta's out, that uterus actually has to physically contract down. So some of it is clotting on the surface to stop bleeding after a pregnancy, but a lot of it has to do with a physical muscular contraction by the uterus that clamps off the blood vessels, kind of like we clamp down our bladder to stop the flow of pee, a muscle contraction. That's the best analogy I can think of. So that when a normal C-section or a routine, I should say, C-section is performed, we take the baby out. We're usually operating. The incision is placed in a very thin part of the uterus, the cervix itself, and we sew that cervix shut, and the uterus clamps down just like it would after a vaginal birth, and the bleeding stops. But for whatever reason, sometimes the uterus stays what we nickname as boggy. So blood stays within the wall. It does not contract down, and there's additional bleeding that is going on, and it may manifest itself in a few different ways. So there are various steps that we can take. Usually the first step is the administration of what we call uterotonics, and that's the broad classification of any medicine that can encourage this muscular contraction. So most people know about the medicine Pitocin. That's a uterotonic. Some people may not know as much about Methergen. It's another uterotonic that we try. There's also a prostaglandin called Hemabate that we try. There are a few others that we've tried, but usually those are the three that are tried most often. If that doesn't work, actually we can physically tie off the blood supply coming into the uterus. And of course, someday that uterus, in order to go on functioning in life, is going to need some blood supply. So we're effectively tying off quite a bit, but not 100%. And some new blood vessels do reform around that area. And sometimes that doesn't even work, so we use actual stitching to sort of tie it up like a package to physically produce that contraction, if you can imagine that. And yes, that may have been what they did. I'm not looking at an operative report, but all of those steps are taken in lieu of taking out the uterus, which sometimes, very rarely, fortunately, has to be done.
Well, it certainly was life-saving. And I'm kind of wondering, what are the long-term implications of having all that stitching?
Well, most often the stitches are stitches that dissolve. And so the stitches dissolve, the uterus involutes, and it's not a surgery that is always done, but it's usually done in mind with future pregnancy in mind, and not a lot. I off the top of my head, I can't even remember seeing a quote-unquote series that's ever looked at. I've seen case reports of women who've had healthy pregnancies after these types of operations, but I can't off the top of my head remember a series. That I'd have to go back to my textbook and read, But of course, it's something that she's going to discuss at her postpartum visit with her physician and when she gets pregnant again with her obstetrician to plan what the strategy will be.
Right. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much for calling and bringing that up. Interesting.
Well, we didn't get to uterine fibroids. Are we almost out of time
here? We have about 2 minutes left.
2 minutes. Okay. Well, I was going to talk about uterine fibroids. About 1/3 of all women do have uterine fibroids. We usually use the terminology that too much pain, too much bleeding, or too big of a size are reasons that uterine fibroids need to be treated. But kind of like the old saying of in real estate, location, location, location. And it's the small fibroids just poking within the wall of the uterus that may not even be enlarging the whole uterus itself that can often be the biggest problem in terms of a heavy period. So actually, there are usually a couple of steps before treating heavy menstrual bleeding with a birth control pill or any other treatment. And that first step is always diagnosis. And often it's an ultrasound that makes that diagnosis. But if it isn't an ultrasound, we use a what's called saline infusion sonohistrography, or SIS for obvious reasons. And we put a little bit of fluid within the cavity of the uterus. It's just done at the same time you get an ultrasound. And we look to see if a woman has a very tiny fibroid, one that can actually be resected out. And there are new instruments that we can use to resect these fibroids out under essentially local anesthesia, which has been an amazing progress in the minor gynecologic surgery realm. And for women who do want to avoid hormones, like one of our earlier callers, absolutely. There are many very strategic non-hormonal treatments of heavy menstrual bleeding, like the treatment of this of a fibroid, or procedures like endometrial ablations, which I didn't have a chance to talk about either.
Well, you can put those on your list for next time.
I will.
And continue. Thank you very much for the hour. It's gone by very quickly.
It did. Dr. Or maybe somebody can write me on my GynoGab blog.
There you go.
I get a lot of questions about ablations and IUDs.
And you can follow up there in probably a little bit more more detail and explain some of the terminology.
Absolutely.
That just kind of breezes by sometimes.
I try to explain.
Dr. Suzanne Troopman, who makes a regular visit to us, is an obstetrician and gynecologist with Women's Health Practice in Champaign and clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at University of Illinois. Thank you much.
Thank you.